Hi, I'm Arlene McIntyre, Creative Director at Ventura Design, and you're listening to Shut the Front Door, a lighthearted podcast that will bring you through the front door and into the homes of influential and interesting people. Home for me is one of the most important things in my life. My career has fortunately given me the opportunity to work closely with people and to help them create a home they will cherish forever. Today on Shut the Front Door, I'm joined by Breast Cancer Ireland CEO, Aisling Hurley. With over 30 years experience in the nonprofit sector, Aisling has dedicated her career to making a difference where it's needed. From creating the University of Limerick Foundation to raising 20 million at the Royal College of Surgeons Development Campaign, Aisling is no doubt an expert in her field. During these challenging times, we wanted to put some special focus back onto charities like Breast Cancer Ireland, so that they are always kept in our minds. For now, it's my great pleasure to welcome Aisling to Shut the Front Door, a CEO, wife, mother, and all-round rugby supporter. Welcome, Aisling.
What an introduction. Hi, Arlene, how are you?
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We were just having a little chat there before we started recording about the current circumstances. What do you think?
Oh, it's very challenging times. I suppose from my point of view, and our biggest concern is our vulnerable patient community, so our breast cancer community, and their fears and their, terrible upset at initially the social distancing and people not social distancing. And now just the length of time they're going to have to stay cocooned in their homes.
Mm-hmm. It is. And do you think that the news is actually really being clear on the situation enough, or do you think they could be a little tougher with everyone?
I think they should be tougher with everybody. I think they're giving the stats, which is brilliant, and they're giving us every day, we get a daily update.
Yeah. And I'd imagine, Aisling, that you are being absolutely bombarded with calls and everyone must be, contacting you regularly, just asking you for advice on how they should manage the situation or deal with the new circumstances they're in.
Sure. And I mean, we got a few very common themed questions coming across. And so I put it to our chairman, who's the lead surgeon in Beaumont Hospital, and he's the head of surgery there. And he answered some of the questions. And mainly their concern was, you know, I'm going through treatment. Do I continue my treatment or do I stay cocooned in my home? And his answer was very clearly that you must follow your medical team's advice. They will be in touch with everybody. They will talk to you. They will explain to you to come or not to come, and to come at a very specific time. For instance, in Beaumont Hospital, they and their breast clinic would on average see about 50 women a day in good times. So at the moment, they've brought that down to 15, and they're basing their cases around severity of cause and risk. So for instance, if the 15 that they bring in, they are the ones that are at higher risk, where they have been referred from GP and the situation is quite urgent. They're being brought into and told to wait in the car park at the hospital, where the breast nurse will contact them directly and they'll be brought in one by one. But these are precautions and protocols that they've had to put in place to safeguard everybody.
Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. And it's just this added stress. You know, everyone is just so terrified of everything at the moment. I mean, I can't even imagine what they're doing. And it's really reassuring to hear that all of those teams are working as hard as they are to, you know, protect the most vulnerable.
Absolutely. And that's the key. And I suppose we've had to realign our strategy in how we do our business, not least working from home, but also from a point of view of looking and seeing how we can be of best assistance to our breast cancer community from a point of view of across social digital platforms. How can we provide, you know, innovative, creative content that will help them, whether it is recipes, you know, cooking recipes from Catherine Fulvio, or it could be fitness Zoom meetings with Anthony Doyle. It's just trying to keep people engaged, that we're saying to them, look, here's what we want to offer you. We want to make life a little easier for you while you are cocooning.
It's just so positive. That is incredible. And tell me, Aisling, how are you managing through the situation personally? Are you working from home at the moment?
Yes, we're working from home. We have a very small team. There's three. And we thankfully, back around the 10th of March, we realized that this might be coming down the track. So we managed to get everybody up and running to work from home. So we do our Zoom meetings every day. It's kind of business as usual. We're coming up with brainstorming plans of how to get ahead of the curve once we come out of this. Because a lot of our events and initiatives have been either cancelled or postponed. So we just need to box clever and think outside the box, per se, to get ourselves in a place where we will be positively able to continue supporting research when we come through.
And how long do you foresee that this will continue?
I think that's a $1 million question, but I did ask someone in the know recently, well, somebody who I would reckon is in the know, and they did say to me that they reckoned that August will be the new norm. End of July, early August will be the new norm. And then their worry is that there could be a surge because of people who will then decide to go traveling on holidays, on business, whatever, and that we could have a surge and be locked down again with academics. Academic programs, they reckon, will not start until January, but it's not known yet. I suppose every day, we've got to take every day as it comes, and it's evolving, and we just have to change with how things are panning out.
Mm-hmm. That's the main thing, really, is just to be as adaptable as you can to really difficult circumstances. And, it's just a huge adjustment for everyone. It's frustrating, but as you say, you've got to box clever and you've got to think outside the box. And like for us all, we're just trying to see how we can move through this situation as best we can and keep our businesses running. And
Exactly. That's the key. And it's about, it's taking time. And I suppose the time we have when we're working at home, we get a little bit more time to brainstorm in peace, where we can think and look and see, well, how can we try to, bridge the gap in funding that we will have lost in this period so that we are still able to support the research when we get through. And, we've been trying a lot. We did a campaign there at the weekend. Our supporters were supposed to dance in a Battle of the Stars event on Saturday, the 4th of April. And they came to us and said, we're raging, we can't do this because this is a great fundraiser for you. But you know what? We're going to do a call out on this Text Cure campaign for a €4 donation. We raised over 10,000 euros in one day.
Incredible. Wow, that's amazing.
And it's initiatives like that and people thinking outside the box that we will get there, I hope.
You will. That is really, really inspiring to hear. So, Aisling, can I ask you just a little bit about yourself personally?
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about your childhood home and where you grew up.
I am originally from Limerick. I grew up in a place, the Dublin side of Limerick, in Castletroy near the University of Limerick. And I'm one of six girls.
Oh, wow. Are you the eldest, the middle girl, the youngest?
I'm in the middle.
You're the middle. Gosh, you've done well for the middle girl.
Yeah, well, I suppose it was always this kind of sense of, work hard and you'll get the reward in the end. Then my father used to drill that into us when we were very young and going off to school, and everybody just, we've all are very happy in where our careers have gone.
Yeah. And have you always had a really strong work ethic?
Yeah. And I think that's something that was just bred into me because all of my sisters have. And it's something that I suppose there's another element to it in that I'm a Virgo. So I'm kind of one of these compulsive, tidy, neat, everything has to get done, workhorse, let's go there. Have no patience, can't wait. I love the buzz of always being on and getting things done.
Yeah. You like structure.
Love it.
And you love checklists, I'd say.
Love checklists. And I suppose, a bit of a control freak, but, if I just need to get it done and I need to know if somebody else is doing it, I'm kind of constantly asking the question, well, where is it? Can I see it? Where can I have a look?
Triple checking.
But that's what makes then, it's my mind is like a washing machine. So there's tens and thousands of things going through it. And it's a case that, okay, I can tick that box and say, okay, that job's done. That's great. I can now move on to something else. So, but look, that's the makeup of me. And everybody that knows me realizes that that's what they're dealing with.
And at what point did you move then to Dublin?
That was 1997. My husband was headhunted to run a company here in Dublin. And so he came up in the January. I was expecting my second child in February. So I hung on in Limerick and I was working at the time for the University of Limerick, which was superb. And then it was a big bold step to say, right, well, I'm coming to Dublin with the two kids. And one of the things that they had asked me in the university was, please don't go to another university and work and develop programs like we've developed, because the University of Limerick was one of the first to set up this foundation back in 1989. So I came to Dublin and I worked for a consultancy firm, a US firm that were fundraising consultants. And I suppose that's where I learned all of what I needed to know.
Wow. So you kind of got a flavor for it then.
And I loved it. I worked with a number of different programs. So, for instance, I would have built programs for Trocra. I built programs for Wesley School and different schools. I built programs for the arts and civil structures. So that's where I really, I suppose, got a passion for when I went into a program. I really got in at very ground level and I understood where they were coming from, so much so that I could then promote it and try and raise funds for it.
Mm-hmm. And you've been absolutely so successful at Breast Cancer Ireland. I mean, you must be very proud of all of that.
I'm really, really proud of it. I mean, it was back in when I was part of the Royal College of Surgeons. Arnie Hill had joined as the head of the medical school. And one of his key things was he had asked the CEO if an event could be organised where funds could go into this account that he had named Breast Cancer Ireland from his days when he was in St. Vincent's. And one of the things they said to me was, well, look, could you run an event for him and we'll give him, you know, 50% of the proceeds. And I said, oh, I hate events. They raise no money. They take up so much time. I said, the only way I would do this is I could get the entire event sponsored. So thankfully, we were very, very fortunate at the time and we did get it sponsored and we raised a lot of money. And as time went on over the years, people started to call the event the Breast Cancer Ireland event. So much so then we decided, well, you know what, maybe we actually need to create an entity, give it good governance and transparency, put a board together, move it outside of the remit of the Royal College of Surgeons and give it its own brand. And so we did that in 2012 and it's just progressed ever since.
Mm-hmm. It really has. Wow. I remember last year, Aisling, when I first met you, you were like the hardest person ever to contact because you're always on an airplane and you're always traveling and you were always going somewhere. Do you like that part of your job, travel?
Yes and no. I mean, I travel purely to meet a lot of our donors. We're meeting a lot of our groups that are working with us and companies that are big sponsors of ours. So for that point, I think face-to-face is fantastic and it's really important. But I love the days when I'm office bound or, you know, working on my laptop that I can just have time to myself to plan and make sure that we're online for where we need to go.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about you as a teenager. Were you always ambitious as a teenager? What was your teenage bedroom like?
Oh, well, I shared it with one of my sisters. So and she's the next one up from me, older than me. But I know it was great. We weren't really big into hanging posters or anything like that, defacing walls. That really wasn't the gig. I was constantly the one, a vivid memory I have as a teenager, I was constantly the one who was on a Saturday morning, my dad would sneak into the bedroom and he'd pull up my duvet and say, you know, Ashley, will you get up and cut the grass and sweep the driveway and clip around the trees? And I'm sitting there going, why me? Why me? What's wrong with the other five? Could you not ask any of them? And my younger sisters are much younger than me. So there's 11 years between me and the youngest set of twins and 7 between me and the next girl. But I used to say about the older two, like, why don't you ask them? So anyway, listen, I did it and it used to kind of annoy me, but, you know, that's made me tough.
Well, maybe he knew you'd get it done. That's why he asked you.
There you go.
You haven't changed a bit, obviously.
There you go.
And how would you describe your own style in your home?
I'm a bit of a neat freak. When you think of Monica and Friends, that's the kind of nickname I get in my head. So you know, people barely have taken the cup out to make a cup of coffee and I have it in the dishwasher and I have everything cleaned up again. So I like a neat, tidy, clutter-free house. Mm-hmm. My mother used to say she'd be afraid to sit down in case I lifted her and put her in the skip because skips into my house quite right. And I do a big clear out. Generally when my husband's not here because he's a bit of a hoarder. So I have to come near the decks when he's gone. And then when he does come looking for things, I have to feign complete ignorance that I don't know where the hell they could be.
They're in the skip.
I'm gone.
So you're super duper organized.
Yeah, which can be a bad thing too. You know, there's times when people would say, would you just please sit and take a minute? But it's kind of in my psyche that I'm constantly on. I'm constantly going and I suppose I do sit. I do take time at the weekends with family. And now that we are all self-isolating, it's actually been a nice transition in that everybody here is, you know, everybody gets up in the morning at regular times as if they're going to work or college or wherever, and they start their work and we meet again at lunchtime and then we go back and we work and then we tend to all go walk and get a bit of exercise outside for an hour or so in the evening. So, and that's working really well. And they're all, because mine are older, they're all now nominating each other to do cooking nights. So somebody's night is X, Y, and Z. So it takes the pressure off.
That's a great idea. So tell me a little bit about your favorite place in your home. Where would you generally go to relax at the end of a really busy day?
I suppose my favorite place is our TV room. It's somewhere where we all congregate there. It's part of our kitchen. It's all a big open living space. But we all tend to congregate there in the evening time. And it's kind of time for chats, time for a little bit of mindless TV, a little bit of news. And it's just an opportunity to catch up with everybody and see what's going on and how everybody's day has gone.
Yeah. And how would you describe your style in general? Would you say that you're a contemporary girl? Are you a classic girl? How would you kind of define your style in your interiors?
I think over the years, because this my current house is, we've only just moved back here since October. And so I've taken a lot of inspiration from, I suppose, different interiors and Pinterest and all of these things. So I would say it's more contemporary. It's nice clean lines. It's nice bright colors. I think it's more contemporary.
And so probably storage would be very important to you, that everything has a place and that everything is very kind of organized. I'd imagine your wardrobe is like a dream wardrobe.
Yeah, well, I'm particularly fond of my wardrobe. Having lived in very cramped previous locations, my wardrobe is now my heaven. It's like a little refuge that I can go in and close the door and everything is there and I can see it. Whereas before I would rummage in open doors and trying to find things. I mean, in our house, they joke because anytime anyone sees me in my business life, I'm in black. So my wardrobe is lots and lots of black. But then all of a sudden in this wardrobe, they now see summer colors and they're surprised.
So you wear your colors at the weekend, probably.
Yep. A lot of the time I would wear colour at the weekend, or I suppose I'm often known to be in tracksuit, legging, gym gear at the weekend when I can relax and out of a suit.
Do you like cooking?
Okay, I have to be truthful. No, not really. So my husband travels a lot. And so when he's away, they hate it because I just do basic dinners for them. So my husband is the main cook in our house and he's really, really talented and he adores cooking. So he will experiment with food.
And would you entertain a lot? Would you have a lot of family and friends around and have gatherings? And do you like entertaining?
We have lots. Because I have some of my sisters now living in Dublin, we would often see and have them over, which is lovely. And my husband just loves to try new food. And anyone that comes to our house is always waiting to see what he'll produce.
Wow, sounds good. And what would you, what would be your one luxury piece in your home? Just the first thing that jumps to mind.
My kitchen.
Your kitchen, right. Mm. Even though you don't cook.
Oh yeah, but I love cleaning it.
I get that. No, I get that. And you probably just like the feeling of the kitchen space as well. It probably feels very homey and cozy.
Big, open, lots of natural light space. It's been a dream come true to have it turn out the way it has. So yeah, I love it.
And do you have any bad habits at all, Aisling?
Wow. Do I have any bad? I'm sure I have loads that people would tell you about. I don't know what they are really, though. What are my bad habits? Maybe that I'm just, I think it's possibly that I do annoy my family, my children, to tidy their rooms constantly. A bit like a broken record player. So, and I do then decide, and my husband kills me because I then go and do the job for them when it's not done.
Yeah, I know all about that. It's just quicker. It's almost easier to do it yourself. And then it's done exactly the way you want it done.
He sort of says, you know, they're big enough. Get them to do it. Why are you doing it? And I'm saying, because it's just easier. I know then it gets...
I know. And a lot of people I've spoken to have said that they just find, organizing space is very relaxing. It almost makes them feel, relaxed in the fact that they're just getting everything around them in its place and organized and folded and sorted. And
yeah, mm-hmm. I love that. That's very therapeutic for me.
Yeah, I get that. And are you a spiritual person, Aisling? I've been asking everyone this question and I'm just curious to know, when you're really stressed, do you meditate?
No, I don't meditate. So in that sense, no. I would have a, I do have a faith, and I do believe in the bigger being. And I do believe that, you know, there are times when I, you know, I sit on my own and I think, you know, I'm very thankful and grateful for having a healthy family around me. And, you know, I have people in my extended family that haven't been well. And, you know, it does bring you back and make you think that, you know, we have to be grateful for what we do have and the health we do have.
Especially in your line of business. I mean, it must be very, very difficult for you, I'd imagine. I'd say you come home sometimes, you know, after some weeks with just a heavy heart, really.
Yes, it can be. It can be, especially, I mean, we've had a very close ambassador for years, Emma Hannigan, and she passed away about 2 years ago last March. And that was devastating because we had become such close friends. So, you know, and the different people that I meet who come and ask, you know, can they talk to Breast Cancer Ireland? Can they support Breast Cancer Ireland? We build very much personal relationships with them. So we're constantly, you know, minding and looking out for them and wanting to ensure that we're doing the best we can do for them.
Yeah. So you've built a sort of a family environment, really.
Very much so, very much so. And even down to, you know, they've come and they've seen the research that goes on in our labs. You know, they've got to meet with some of the key clinicians and scientists, and they get that the monies that they're out there trying to raise on our behalf and talking about the important research, that it is actually going into making a difference. You know, we have one lady and she's currently a stage 4 breast cancer patient, but she's on a clinical trial that came on the market about 18 months ago. And it's made a massive difference to her life. She's heading into her third year living with cancer, but living. And that's the key. And I mean, this is where clinical trials are so important. We have to keep investing in research in order to, you know, positively change the dial for future generations.
Absolutely. And do you feel that social media is a real positive for you in getting that message out there and helping you?
It's definitely a good tool. You know, people will listen and say, oh God, asking her about social media. I'm a bit of a technophobe when it comes to it. I have to get my kids to show me all about Instagram, etc. But I do believe that it is a powerful tool. And I believe more so now than ever, during this self-isolation period and cocooning period, digital media is key because people are at home, and while they're working at home, they still have time and they're looking at the social media channels, be it Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And so we've had to realign our strategy in relation to our social media. And we're really much now talking to our breast cancer community. We're trying to give them tools. For instance, we're trying to offer them content that's innovative and creative, offer them recipes and cooking demonstrations, offer them online fitness programs that they can join in with all the family while they're at home, you know, wellness, offer them an opportunity to have a voice. And I'm seeing that they definitely are engaging much more now than even in the past.
Absolutely. Because I mean, people really probably would never understand how much is involved behind the scenes in what you do every day and how much organizing is involved. And it's just endless.
It is endless. And I've, you know, I kind of brought it back to our team and said, you know, we have two remits at the moment. One is to really look after our vulnerable community. And the other is to think of creative ways that we can raise funding during this really awful time when a lot of our events and our initiatives have been cancelled or postponed. So, and it's about really trying to get ahead of the curve once we come out of this.
Yeah, that's a full-time challenge. But no doubt, I mean, that's a really special and important cause. I can't see people ever taking their focus off this. I mean, it's very relevant and it's happening every day to so many people. So I think it'll always be, you know, at the forefront of a lot of people's minds.
Yes. And I mean, every charity has a very noble purpose. And I suppose for us, we see firsthand. I mean, the statistics are 1 in 9 women will be diagnosed in their lifetime. I mean, that's, you know, in a family like mine, where there's 7 women, you know, the chances are, and unfortunately and sadly, you know, I went maybe up to 3 years ago, nobody had been touched in my family. And 3 years ago, I remember doing an interview and somebody saying, you know, you're so passionate about what you do and the statistic is so high and you're 1 of 7 women in a family. And oh my goodness, it's 1 in 9. And I said, yeah. And we were talking. And about 2 weeks later, my mother rang me and she said, you're not going to believe this. She had been diagnosed with breast cancer, but it had been very early. So her treatment was she had had a lumpectomy and she had to have radiation therapy. And I, at the time, said to her, you know, Mom, I know, and there's other medics in my family, and they were all so terribly shocked and saddened by the news. And I said to her, Mom, it's 12 months where you have to go through this regime of radiation and all the treatment that comes with that. And you're going to feel horrible for 12 months. But I promise after this, you will look back and say, wow, I got through this. And she has got through it. She's back golfing. She's back traveling. Well, she was until about early March. But she will again. And that's the thing that people, it's so important to keep the mind positive, regardless of the prognosis.
Yeah, definitely. My gosh, your poor mum. And where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Oh, that's another $1 million question. I'd love to be at a point where I obviously will still be working because I'm passionate about what I do, but I would love to see that we are getting to a point where our survival rates are increasing, even they're getting better. So at the moment, we've got it up from about 75 up to maybe 85 at the moment. I'd love to get that over 90. I'd love to see us widening the gap for breast screening. At the moment, it's about, you know, we breast screen from 50 to 70. We really should bring it down to 40 and out up to perhaps, you know, 75. The only problem with that, and this is where I don't think people understand, is that for younger women to be put into the breast screening initiative, which costs money, is that younger women, their breast tissue is white, it's active. And as you get older, it goes gray and then it goes into dark black. So cancer shows up white. So being able to detect it early is very difficult in a younger woman. But it is the most effective screening tool we have, and it is the most reliable. So I'd love to see our screening age profile expanding. I'd love to see our mortality rates improving, because ultimately my end game is, as I started Breast Cancer Ireland, one of the key things I asked was, you know, will we ever find a cure in my lifetime? And we're never going to find a cure for it, because there are a gazillion permutations of breast cancer. No two women have the same breast cancer, and their prognosis and their treatment will be very different. And that's why it's become more personalized and tailored treatment plans. But I said, well, okay, so, but could I get it from changing the dial from it sometimes being often being fatal? We have about 680 deaths annually, into a treatable long-term illness, a bit like, you know, you have cholesterol, we give you Lipitor, we keep your cholesterol at bay. Can we get breast cancer to that point where people don't pass? And we definitely are making headway towards that. I mean, even in the last, I'm in this now 8 years of Breast Cancer Ireland, I've seen significant improvements. We have new drugs coming on. We have, you know, we were talking to the big pharma companies. There's about five in the world that produce a particular breast cancer drug. We've already got two of them talking to each other to give a particular cocktail drug into clinical trial for a large cohort of trial patients. And it's proving hugely successful. So my ultimate aim would be, well, can we not get all five of you to pool together and create a bigger cocktail that can go out to a much wider cohort of patient groupings? And let's see, can we really, really make a difference here?
That's exciting. My God, incredible. Mm-hmm. And is there any message of hope you'd love to share with the listeners today, particularly, you know, during this pandemic?
I think the most important thing is to respect our vulnerable community, be they our elderly and also our at-risk groups. I think the most important thing we can do, and the best way we can help everybody, is by staying apart. We should do this together by very, very clearly staying apart, staying away and keeping our distance, and, you know, being mindful of all the restrictions that are in place. We will get there and we will get through this. And if you look historically at China, they are coming through. So we will get there. It's going to take time, but, you know, people's lives are at risk and we really do need to safeguard them.
Yeah. Now I'm going to ask you a few quick fire questions. So it's just one or the other you've got to give me an answer for. So, Aisling, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Bath or shower?
Shower.
Text or talk?
Text.
Tea or coffee?
Tea.
Bedside left or right?
Right.
Cat or dog?
Dog.
Red or white wine?
Oh, both. Red.
Taxi or walk?
Taxi.
Home or abroad?
Home.
Boris or Trump?
Oh, neither.
Good answer. Thank you so much for joining us today, Aisling.
Thanks a million, Arlene.
And stay safe.
You too. Thanks very much.